is Mark. I'm Deborah Potter, CBS News.
If I can't be not just a respectable speaker, but an effective speaker, then I wouldn't want to be speaker.
It would appear that he has determined to try to end this through a resignation.
The political ordeal of House Speaker Jim Wright may be almost over.
I'm Judy Muller, CBS News.
Certainly in the cases of many other women I got to know in the shelter, it was a desperate last resort.
Homeless women. Our Newsmark broadcast learns some reasons why they are on the street.
I'm Charles Osgood, CBS News.
If you told me I was working for the Department of Army in the Arlington National Cemetery 10, 15 years ago, I would have said you're crazy. But here I am, and I have a lot of pride in working here, and I've gained a lot of respect in a certain sense, I guess you would say, of patriotism that I didn't have before.
On this Memorial Day weekend, we'll visit Arlington National Cemetery, symbol of so much national pride and private sorrow. Our Newsmark broadcast begins in 1 minute.
Mom, can you hear me? The doctor says you can't. But, I'm sorry, Mom, really sorry. I mean, how could I do this? I wouldn't hurt you, Mom. I love you. You make me crazy sometimes, but never like taking a knife, not cutting you. Hey, I wasn't on drugs, Mom. Believe me. I told you I... And I'm lying, Mom. You can't even hear me, and I'm lying again. But, Mom, I couldn't tell you. You and Dad would have killed me. You don't know about drugs. Parents don't know. You just make speeches. Well, it's not that easy. It's hard. They pressure you, tell you it's cool. And you get so cool, you don't even know how messed up you are. You don't know, Mom. Well, I guess you do now. I sure showed you, didn't I? Oh, God, Mom, please wake up. Talk to me. Please help me, Mom. Please help me.
The Partnership for a Drug-Free America.
Newsmark. I'm Deborah Potter, CBS News. It was a week of turmoil on Capitol Hill, speculation swirling that House Speaker Wright was poised to do what many within his own party have been saying he has to do, step down. His problems have all but paralyzed the Congress for most of the year, as the House Ethics Committee debated the allegations against him and then charged him with violating House rules. This week, Wright's lawyers, including Stephen Sussman, urged the committee to dismiss the most serious charges.
Why worry about due process for a dead man? Why should this committee stand in the way of a lynch mob? I'll tell you why. Because if a member of Congress, indeed the most powerful member of Congress, cannot get a fair trial, no American can.
But committee counsel Richard Phelan said the case against Wright is clear and the implications of dropping any charges could be serious.
What we are dealing with is the integrity of this institution. We are dealing with the confidence of the American public in the members that serve here and the rules that they are obliged to follow.
When the Ethics Committee met the following day to review the arguments, several members said they had heard nothing new. The suggestion that Wright would fail to get any charges dismissed, which would be seen as a major defeat. But behind the scenes, intermediaries for Wright were trying to strike a deal to get the committee to dismiss at least one charge in exchange for the speaker's resignation. Representing the speaker, Congressman Robert Torricelli, who said progress was made on getting a key charge dismissed.
Came very close, and I think that still is a majority view of members of the Ethics Committee, in my opinion.
But Democrat Alan Mollahan, who was on the committee, said the exchanges never got far enough to be called a plea bargain.
If there were negotiations, they were certainly tentative, and I think it's more accurate to describe them as explorations as to whether it would be appropriate to talk about negotiations, and evidently the answer to that was no.
One reason, the firm opposition of some committee Republicans, including John Myers.
I think the integrity of the House of Representatives, of the House Committee on Standards of Official Conduct, and as an individual member, and our responsibility to the American people, we should not be involved in any so-called deal.
With the effort collapsing, the Speaker issued a statement saying, there is no deal now and there will be no deal in the future. He insisted he did not initiate the discussions and did not want to be party to a negotiated arrangement. Wright also denied that he ever offered to resign in return for any arrangement with the committee. But he pointedly did not say that he would not resign. And sources close to Wright said they now expect that he will, probably next week, before the committee can rule on whether to dismiss any of the charges, becoming thereby the first speaker in modern history to be driven out of office by scandal. His advisors, however, are split, with lawyer Sussman urging him to fight on.
I think the speaker ought to stick it out and tough it out and let the American people say that Congress can give a fair hearing with due process, even in the political arena.
But Democrat Pat Williams says the indications are that Wright will probably take the advice of those who believe he should step down.
It would appear that he has determined to try to end this through a resignation. Jim is an old hand. He's an old Paul. He knows injured goods when he sees it, and he understands that the powerful, important, critical office of the Speaker has been injured.
The man considered most likely to succeed Wright, Majority Leader Tom Foley, insists that he doesn't believe it.
I have no expectation that the Speaker is going to resign. There isn't any likelihood that I can see of any vacancies occurring in the immediate future.
But already House Democrats are preparing for the succession. Wright's departure also would bring a heavy sigh of relief on Capitol Hill. Democrats had begun to see him as a political liability, fearful that their association with Wright would put them in jeopardy come election time. And members of both parties say they want to get on with the business of Congress that has been stymied by the Speaker's problems. There is no joy at the apparent outcome, but this has been a painful chapter in the life of Congress that everyone on Capitol Hill wants to close. I'm Deborah Potter, CBS News in Washington.
I'm Frank Settapani, CBS News, New York. A weekend announcement makes it clear that the question of leadership for the Democrats is far from over. Tony Coelho, the majority whip and the man thought most likely to replace Majority Leader Thomas Foley, if Foley replaces Jim Wright, announced that he will resign his seat next month rather than face a lengthy inquiry into his finances. The turmoil of this week in Congress looks set to continue for the month to come. I'm Frank Settapani, CBS News. Newsmark will continue in a moment.
A Life Alert two-way voice communication home security system can save your life. Listen to the ex-deputy police chief of San Diego.
The likelihood of you becoming a victim in your home, if you have a first-class security system, is 3 to 4,000% less than your neighbor who does not have one. Once you install a Life Alert protector system, you'll find that you sleep at night because your home truly is being protected. It's something that anyone can afford.
Imagine confronting a robber or a rapist and being able to summon the exact kind of help you need virtually instantly without touching a telephone. You can with Life Alert. Get free facts by mail about this inexpensive life-saving system right away. To get complete free details through the mail, call now.
Call 1-800-94-ALERT. That's 1-800-94-ALERT. Call 1-800-94-ALERT. Toll free, 1-800-94-ALERT.
Newsmark, I'm Judy Muller, CBS News.
Wendy and Amanda specifically are the products of middle-class homes.
Wendy and Amanda, names for two of the nameless faces that live in our alleys. Names for two of the dozens of homeless women that reporter Kathleen Hirsch has met and studied.
They grew up in the suburbs of Boston. Amanda's parents were both very accomplished museum-trained artists. Her dad worked as an engineer to support the family. Wendy's parents were also working class. She grew up about 3 miles away from Amanda. She was a straight-A student in school. She dreamed of going to Paris after she graduated from high school on a scholarship. By the time they were 30, both of them were homeless.
The question, of course, is why?
Both of them were abused as children. Wendy became an alcoholic pretty early on. She discovered alcohol as an escape from her stepfather's sexual advances. Amanda's dad was an alcoholic and took out his frustration on his youngest daughter. It was too much for her. She ended up repeating a couple of grades of school, and they were both off and running in cycles of loss and self-destruction.
Reporter Hirsch says she discovered a pattern of childhood abuse among homeless women.
When I first started working in the shelters, I didn't really know what to expect. I didn't know whether most of the women would be deinstitutionalized mentally ill patients or whether they would be very poor women who had just fallen out of the bottom of the economic ladder. I was stunned at the prevalence of childhood abuse in these stories, and I got to know about 100 women.
Homeless women turn to the street when all other doors seem closed. Hirsch cites Amanda's story.
She had moved to Boston just desperate to get away from her home situation. And she got a job and managed to keep it for 7 or 8 years as a clerk. And then the company folded. She had her own apartment. She felt very good about her life at that point. But that crucial support system for her, her colleagues at work, disappeared when the company folded. She moved back in with her sister. All the predictable tensions that would arise from having both grown up in a dysfunctional family surfaced very quickly. She wasn't welcome, and she felt there was nowhere else for her to go.
The problem, Hirsch feels, is not so much a lack of housing as it is a breakdown of social structure.
I think increasingly we're becoming a dysfunctional society. Our families are no longer able to meet the personal crises of their members in such a way that the children can be protected from them, for instance. Our neighborhoods are no longer even coherent enough for neighbors to recognize what's happening to the kids next door. We barely even know the kids next door anymore. I think there's just a sense of alienation that's pervading society, and I think that that is creating the holes. I think that that old-fashioned informal network of mutual aid and support that used to be there is just not there anymore. We're all too busy.
And the key to getting off the street is not just finding a home. It is also rebuilding that social support system.
Amanda had been chronically homeless for 6 years when I met her. She'd been in and out of the shelters 3 times. She had made it out of the shelter into an apartment again. What she hadn't done until this time around was construct the kind of support system for herself that she needed once in an apartment. Now she has it. She has friends. She has a therapist. She has very, very supportive colleagues at work. They all know that she's been homeless. They all know where she's coming from, and they're very supportive and very proud of her. And as a result, she has the wherewithal to move on. But a lot of homeless women have been so damaged early in life that they really have serious self-esteem problems. And I think we need to realize that what's needed is to help these women believe in themselves again. That's the first step.
Hirsch says the longer a woman stays on the street, the poorer her chances to escape it.
I think the chances that women can get off the street and back into housing are very good, provided they're caught quickly enough. I think women who have been on the streets for a long time have been hurt so much by the street conditions and indeed by their lives before they were homeless that it's very difficult for them to trust in anything.
But in addition to helping women who are already homeless, Hirsch says, we must change the climate that is creating the problem.
I feel that we need to look carefully at preventative measures. And if we don't, we're going to have tens of thousands more homeless people on the street in the next 20 years. We need to strengthen our child abuse laws. We need to allow women who are being battered to somehow stay in their houses with their children, deal with the offenders in such a way that women do not have to flee these situations to escape violence. I think that we also need to look at the way we're raising our own children. Take more time to nurture our family life. That's critical.
Kathleen Hirsch, whose new book, Songs from the Alley, records the lament of women without homes. I'm Judy Muller, CBS News. Our Newsmark broadcast continues in 1 minute.
Hi, I'm Dom DeLuise.
And I'm his wife, Carol.
And we want to tell you about someone who is very special to our family.
For the last 18 years, we've been sponsoring Amerasian children through the Pearl S. Buck Foundation, currently Vanessa in the Philippines.
You see, half American kids like Vanessa live in terrible poverty in Asia.
They don't get enough food, seldom receive medical care. Often they're subject to scorn and ridicule.
The insults bothered Vanessa so much she couldn't study. And education is the best defense Amerasians have against prejudice.
I'm so glad the Pearl S. Buck Foundation found her and that our family could help by sponsoring her.
That's right. The foundation reaches tens of thousands of children in 5 Asian countries. It helps them get food, shelter, medical care, and especially education.
To learn more about how your family can share in the joys of sponsorship, call the Pearl S. Buck Foundation, 1-800-242-BUCK.
That's 1-800-242-BUCK.
Newsmark, I'm Charles Osgood, CBS News. Here is a familiar sound of Memorial Day. A military band playing at Arlington National Cemetery. This 3-day weekend is often thought of as simply the first holiday of the summer. But surely it is also a time in which at least passing thought might be given to the men and women who died for this country. And nowhere in this nation is the spirit of honor and sacrifice more evident than here at Arlington. It has been called the history of our country engraved in granite. The cemetery is in Arlington, Virginia, on a slope overlooking the Potomac River. At the top of one hill is the home of Robert E. Lee. It's been restored as a memorial to the Confederate general. Across the river, the memorial to Abraham Lincoln can be seen in the distance. Between them are thousands of wind-bleached headstones that attract more than 3 million visitors each year.
Dear, once you sign, please go to the white line in the rear next to the blue and white window.
At the visitor's center, they wait in line to buy tickets for a guided bus tour through the cemetery or for information about the locations of particular graves.
Okay, is this where you get information about relatives buried? Okay, the last name is Dickerson, D-I-C-K-E-R-S-O-N.
There are more than 210,000 people buried here. Historian Tom Sherlock.
Many people are astonished when they hear that because they look out over the acres and acres and see the stones and stones, and I think that's a real sobering experience for them when they see that and realize that every stone was, you know, represents a person and their life and their story and the people they love and the people love them. That's when I think the reality of sacrifice and honor really, it really hits you.
One of the most visible signs of that pride is the 3rd Infantry of the U.S. Army, the elite outfit known as the Old Guard. Their duty, to bury and honor the dead at Arlington with compulsive perfection. That includes accompanying the caisson at certain military funerals. Philip Bigler, former Arlington historian and author of a book about the cemetery called In Honored Glory, watched one of the processions with us.
The casket is just about ready to come out of the chapel now. The honor guard will come to attention when the casket comes out, and then it will be placed on the caisson by a casket team of 6 Navy soldiers. This is the Navy band that is performing here because this is a lieutenant commander who is being buried here. We have a contingent of Navy sailors here that are a firing platoon with honor guard weapons. We have a flag team as well with the American flag and the Navy colors. And then we'll have a marching platoon that walks with the behind the caisson to the gravesite. Casket arrives at the gravesite. It's placed on a lowering device. The flag is then held outstretched by the 6 casket teams. Then prayers are rendered over the gravesite, and then the flag will be folded into a triangle. The triangle is reminiscent of the tri-corner hats of the American Revolution and is then presented to the widow or the next of kin. And then military services are rendered, which will include the playing of taps and firing of gun volleys.
Taps is probably the most familiar ritual of the military funeral. Sergeant First Class Henry Segrisi of the U.S. Army Band says he's probably performed it at more than 500 funerals since he first came to Arlington.
After the first few times back in 1974 when the nerves went away, it was just a matter of trying to keep my concentration, you know, day in and day out.
It was at his first funeral that Sergeant Segrisi had the most trouble keeping his concentration.
When we reached gravesite, we were given the instruction to change to a different selection of music, and I took my lyre and turned it around and was fumbling with it, and the music fell on the ground. I didn't know what to do, so I backed up to get it, and of course that was the wrong thing to do, and I couldn't get it because I was so nervous. So I left it and went back to join the band and caused a little scene in having left and then come back, and then I didn't even have my music, so I didn't know what to play.
Sergeant Segrisi hasn't had any major slip-ups since then. He has played taps at important occasions, such as wreath-laying ceremonies for heads of state. His mother, Anna Segrisi of Watkins Glen, New York, says she's even seen her son perform on television.
We've been looking for a long time, but we're really honored on Memorial Day. And he was asked to play taps at the Vietnam Memorial. And we've always been looking, but we've never seen him. But all of a sudden, at 11 o'clock at night, here was Henry, bright as day, on TV. So that was, I think, the most exciting moment of my life, maybe.
Sergeant Segrisi's father, Dominic, has watched his son play at Arlington several times.
When he gets done and he comes up and stands talking with my wife and I notice that people look around and say, hey, you know, they must be related to the guy. And it makes you quite proud, you know.
I'm Charles Osgood, CBS News. We'll visit the most revered graves at Arlington and talk to some of the men who guard them when our Newsmark broadcast continues.
Marty Schwartz, Executive Car Leasing Company.
Why is Executive the largest car leasing company in California, and how do we get so many referrals? The answer is service. During my 7 years at Executive, the most wonderful experience I've had was with a young married couple. Executive put them in a terrific sports car. It really fit their yuppie lifestyle. Sometime later on, the wife is expecting a baby, and they asked me about a wagon. Their original lease was structured properly, and Executive started searching for the right deal so that the switch wouldn't cost them any additional money. Well, we delivered the wagon about a week before she did. You might say it was a new lease on life. I'll tell you this, it gave me a lot of personal satisfaction.
For the car of your choice at a price that will amaze you, call Executive today at 213-654-5000. Before you lease or buy, make Executive your first call. 213-654-5000. Executive has offices in Los Angeles, the San Fernando Valley, Orange County, and Palm Springs to serve you.
Newsmark. I'm Charles Osgood, CBS News. It's been more than 100 years since a Union Army General, John Alexander Logan, first issued an order creating a day to decorate the graves of fallen comrades and to pray for peace. Those orders are still carried out on the last Monday in May across the country, but Memorial Day ceremonies have a special meaning at Arlington National Cemetery. Arlington is known as the nation's burial ground, the final resting place for generals and privates, for presidents and politicians, the famous and the anonymous.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? I am Corporal Davis of the 3rd Infantry Regiment, United States Army, Assistant Relief Commander, Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. The ceremony you are about to witness is the changing of the guard.
This is one of the most popular tourist sites at Arlington, the changing of the guard at the Tomb of the Unknowns. There are four unknowns buried here from World War I, World War II, and the Korean and Vietnam conflicts. Inscribed on the facade of the tomb, the phrase, "Here rests in honored glory an American soldier known but to God." This is the nation's most sacred shrine to American servicemen.
Right now, there's probably about 300 or 400 people who've gathered here to watch this ceremony.
Author Philip Bigler watched it with us.
Oh, what?
The soldiers who are in charge of the tomb are the 3rd United States Infantry from Fort Myer. They are Army.
Pass on yours. Post and orders. Remain as directed. Orders acknowledged. Ready?
Although it's a very impressive sight at 12 noon in the on a Saturday or on a Sunday, you have to remember that there is someone here 2 o'clock in the morning in January when it's bitterly cold or when it's raining or snowing. There is someone here always with these four unknown soldiers. There are three release of sentinels on duty here. They're on duty for 24 hours straight and then off for 48. They stay here at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. There is a tomb quarter beneath the Memorial Amphitheater, and they are here overnight during their rotation.
The tomb quarters, which is not open to the public, is one of the few places a sentinel can relax. But not for long. The assistant relief commander you just heard leading the changing of the guard is Corporal Jeffrey Davis. He performs that ceremony sometimes as often as 24 times a day.
By the time you go out for the last time at 6:30, you are definitely tired. When you get it perfect, you know, you come downstairs and you feel good. When somebody asks you why you're doing it, when you're guarding the unknowns.
I love it. I love it. I've been trying to get here at the Too Many Unknown Soldiers since 1982.
Staff Sergeant Otis Durden is a relief commander at the tomb, the man in charge of this group of sentinels.
Who's going up? Okay, go ahead and bring him around, please.
His job, to make sure the sentinel looks perfect.
It takes, like, one additional guy to get another guy dressed, so it's like two guys getting dressed at one time. And the reason why this is done is because the blouse, or what you might call a coat, isn't actually tapered or tailored to us. So what we do is just take the excess material, and we pull it around to the rear and tuck it in underneath the tight belt that we wear.
The size of that belt is just 29 inches.
If your waist isn't down there, you, of course, run into some problems.
The process looks even more difficult than squeezing into a tight girdle. Once the sentinel is dressed, he practices his rifle moves one more time, then marches out to the tomb with the relief commander.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? I am Staff Sergeant Durden of the 3rd Infantry Regiment, United States Army.
Sergeant Durden has another important ceremonial job. He leads groups that come to lay a wreath at the tomb.
Order!
Every president since Woodrow Wilson has come to Arlington to place a wreath on the Tomb of the Unknowns. It's one of the most familiar rituals of Memorial Day. Thousands of people also come to see the individual flags placed on every grave and to attend ceremonies in the Memorial Amphitheater. The theme is always the same, national pride.
It gives us a time to get what we really take for granted and what that we have to look forward to and hope that we don't have another war, that people die like this.
It means something to me that these men, many of them not just died of natural causes, but many of them are killed. I think it's a wonderful thing that we have a place like this that you can come back to and look at.
Arlington is the kind of place that you can come back to again and again and be moved each time. The kind of place the poet Theodore O'Hara must have envisioned. Sections of one of his famous poems were placed on bronze plaques throughout Arlington Cemetery during the 19th century. They are still there. On fame's eternal camping ground, their silent tents are spread. And glory guards with solemn round the bivouac of the dead. Nor shall your story be forgot while fame her record keeps, or honor points the hallowed spot where valor proudly sleeps. I'm Charles Osgood, CBS News. Newsmark segments for this week were produced by Evelyn Lee, Richard Stapleton, and Jill Landis. The executive producer of Newsmark is Richard Stapleton. Newsmark is a presentation of CBS News.